Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures, telling stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character for over 50 years. Details at texancultures.utsa.edu.
Welcome to Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Mexico's political history is one of upheaval. You could say it dates back to the Spanish conquest of the 16th century. Further down the timeline, Mexico declared its independence from Spain in the 19th century. The Mexican-American War ended in 1848, with Mexico ceding nearly half its territory to the U.S. The Mexican Revolution drove thousands of Mexicans to flee to the U.S. for their lives in a power struggle that cost over a million lives. That power struggle continues to the present day. Assassinations, massacres, kidnappings, and cartels have shaped Mexico's recent history. Alex Avina is an associate professor of history at Arizona State University. He researches 20th century Mexico, in particular, its revolutionary movements, state violence, and narcotics trafficking. He says the drug violence that's overwhelmed Mexico today has its roots in the Mexican Revolution.
I mean, we can trace this back to the Mexican Revolution of 1910 and the subsequent 3 decades that it took to build a somewhat stable post-revolutionary government that had some level of legitimacy in the eyes of its Mexican population. But already during the Mexican Revolution, we see, for instance, the governor of Baja California, who was a colonel in the military, but was also involved in drug trafficking. So, you know, my research starts in southern Mexico in the 1960s and 1970s in the state of Guerrero. And there's extensive political violence and state violence that's practiced against a series of Pacific peaceful social movements that are organizing, and they're using the language of the Mexican Constitution. They're using civic right language, you know, demanding that the Mexican government fulfill what some of these social and political rights that exist in paper in the Mexican Constitution. And when they organize these mass movements throughout the 1960s, when they organize in these peaceful ways, they do marches, they do occupations, you know, they're met with violence, whether it's, you know, in the form of the military being sent in to oppress them, or state police forces, or gunslingers that work for the governor or local landed elites. And they come to the conclusion that the only way to achieve meaningful reform in Mexico is to wage armed struggle. They have legitimacy and they seem like a viable political option to achieve freedom, to achieve social justice, armed struggle. So by 1970, we have these two peasant guerrilla movements that emerge in the state of Guerrero, a state that's made famous by Acapulco, these resort cities. And my first book chronicles these two peasant guerrilla movements led by school teachers, Lucio Cabañas and Genaro Vázquez. So while I was doing research for that book, this was about 2005, 6, 7, and 8, I kept coming across documents that talked about the military that was sent in to eradicate these guerrilla movements were also involved in drug trafficking to a certain extent. I came across documents where you saw alliances being forged between counterinsurgent military units and local narcos to wipe out the guerrillas. You know, apart from my first book, I interviewed people who had lost, whose sons and daughters had been disappeared by the Mexican military because they were accused of being guerrillas. At the same time that happened, in 2007, one of my uncles was disappeared, and he's part of the now 60,000 disappeared people that we think have occurred in Mexico since 2006. So for me, it was this weird convergence of the history that I was researching with a very personal family history coming together. And then brings me to 2014, when you had these young college students in Ayotzinapa, Guerrero, who were disappeared, right, the 43. And it was like another reminder that I have to tease out what is the connection between these guerrilla movements, the political violence that happens in Guerrero in the 70s, and at the same time, this exploding global economy of narcotics, and what place Guerrero occupied within that. And what my current research looks at is that while the Mexican military was in Guerrero wiping out these guerrilla movements and the communities that supported them, they're also helping to establish the infrastructure of a very profitable first marijuana and then later opium poppy political economy.
Well, it's kind of interesting hearing about, you know, the state violence against this peasant movement, guerrilla movements, and there's a really kind of interesting international thread to it, because you see it not just in Mexico, not just in Guerrero, but Chiapas, for example. Not too long ago, there was violence there. And of course, in the 1980s, Central America, the Contras, and the disappeared during the Spanish Civil War. There seems to be almost this common thread of the government wanting to silence its people for trying to do the right thing.
When you see these armed revolutionary movements emerge, you know, it's a long process, and it's a long dialogical process that they've had with a state, in this instance, the Mexican state, that during the 60s and 70s refused to negotiate in a meaningful and just way, convincing many that the only way to achieve reform in that sense was to take up arms. One way to track what the U.S. empire is doing globally and in Latin America is to trace its drug policies, right? So you brought up Central America in the 80s, right? The whole Iran-Contra scandal that breaks out, this covert operation that involved Colombian and Honduran narco-traffickers bringing cocaine into the United States and using those profits to fund contra-revolutionaries in Nicaragua to destabilize the Sandinista. I mean, that is a lot of what I'm saying to your listeners might sound as conspiratorial because it sounds that crazy. The fact that this actually happened, to me, is even more crazy. That you have intelligence agencies using drugs and using the cover of a war on drugs to facilitate really nefarious clandestine operations to destabilize governments that they deem as national security threats to the United States. And in the 80s in the United States, you get this weird thing where you have the CIA working with narco traffickers to illegally fund counter-revolutionaries in Nicaragua at the same time that you have Nancy Reagan waging this public health campaign saying, just say no to drugs. And to me, it's this weird dissonance between what the Reagan administration was doing then with regards to U.S. consumption of drugs, but they're also facilitating the production of those very and the circulation of those very drugs that are coming into the United States. So you have this weird like loop that feeds off of itself, and it just keeps going in a circle. And to me, that's the way I tend to think about the war on drugs in general. One is that it's a war on poor people. It's a war on the lowest level of consumers in the United States. It targets people of color, users of color disproportionately. It has decimated communities of color since the 1970s. But it's also a war on poor people in places like southern Mexico because those drug interdiction campaigns focus on the farmers. They focus on the lowest levels of the drug economy. Now we see this kingpin strategy once in a while where they go after the top cartel leader, which actually is very ineffective and generates more violence. But the war on drugs is a war on poor people internationally, both on the consumption side and on the production side.
Alex Aviña is a historian and professor whose research focuses on 20th century Mexico. He's the author of Specters of Revolution, Peasant Guerrillas in the Cold War Mexican Countryside. When we come back, the war on drugs in Mexico falls on the shoulders of the United States.
There's a direct responsibility, American responsibility, for the violence that's occurring in Mexico.
More with Alex Aviña next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Drug traffickers in Mexico often worked hand in hand with the state to suppress political dissidents and social protest movements in the 1970s. Cartels made deals with police in the 80s to provide protection to criminal organizations. Former Mexican President Felipe Calderón declared a war on cartels in 2006. That action escalated the violence. Since then, over 300,000 people have been killed in cartel violence. 40,000 people have disappeared. What's fueling that violence? Drug demand in the U.S. Alex Aviña is an associate professor of history at Arizona State University. He researches 20th century Mexico, in particular its revolutionary movements, state violence, and narcotics trafficking. Aviña says the solution to drug violence is a lot more complicated than drug legalization.
That is a really complicated question. So legalization as an idea has to be transnational for it to work, at least in Mexico and the United States. The current president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, when he was on the campaign trail, he talked a lot about legalization. But it's not a silver bullet. Because as I mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, the war on drugs or this issue is connected to long-standing, broader, you know, questions of political control, political power at the local and regional levels in Mexico. So just by simply going into a place like Guerrero, which now, up until recently, was producing 60 to 70% of all the heroin in Mexico, it's not going to solve everything. It's part of a broader set of questions and problems that have existed for, I don't want to say centuries, I don't want to get too dramatic as a historian, but at least for decades. You know, legalization is something that I think could work if it's part of a broader, comprehensive, transnational set of reform proposals. Another proposal that's been put forth in Mexico is crop substitution, right? So going into Guerrero and asking these mostly opium poppy producing farmers, don't grow that. You know, we're going to help you grow another crop that's quote unquote licit, and we'll give you economic support, you know, credit, fertilizer, will help you build roads to get your product to the market.
Yeah, but if you look at, you know, the avocado crops in Mexico, the cartels are coming in on that. So there really is no safe crop.
Right. That's I mean, you anticipated I was going to say, right? I mean, so in that sense, it's not necessarily about the crop or the commodity. To a certain extent, this is a problem of laissez-faire or free trade capital, neoliberal capitalism. Because you have a crop substitution program. You say, we're going to grow aguacates, avocados in Guerrero. It's still going to operate in an economy that's not designed to produce a fair outcome. For this type of economy to work, it's going to depend on the growers at the bottom and their laborers generating a certain level of return that cannot exceed that of the companies, of the investors, of the credit providers, of the people who are building roads. So to a certain extent, this is the drug problem, as I tell my students. It's also a capitalism problem, right? It's a problem of inequality. It's a problem of an economic system that is based on the exploitation of many by a few, right? So you can do crop substitution, you can do legalization, but as you just pointed out, that doesn't necessarily going to mean that these growers are going to get a just return for their labor and their products. And it also doesn't signify that criminal organizations are not going to somehow get involved in the quote-unquote licit economy and control it from without. And avocados, I mean, I find a lot of the reporting on the blood avocados a bit problematic for a variety of reasons. The fact that they focus on that, they know it's because an American audience will actually listen or read that story, right? Because they need their avocados. Again, it's only almost the entry point into a really contested, complicated nest of problems that have existed in the region for a long time. And a lot of those problems have been exacerbated since the 80s, and especially since NAFTA in the early 1990s, when the Mexican economy went through what economists refer to as structural readjustment, which essentially means, you know, the opening up of the economy and retransforming Mexico into an export-oriented economy. Drugs have operated and have thrived within this economy. NAFTA has really been good for Mexican drug traffickers.
Well, explain how. I mean, that's kind of interesting. How about the new NAFTA? How about the USMCA?
I actually don't see much of a difference between the old and the new NAFTA. So avocados, right? It took a long time for the American growers to allow Mexican avocados to actually come into the United States, and growers in California and Florida were really angry about it. It took a long time to allow Mexican truckers and trucks to come into the U.S. But the idea that now you were going to have a quote-unquote open border between Mexico and the United States in reference to commodities and capital flows, that's what drug traffickers needed, right? Because when we think about how drugs enter from Mexico into the United States, the overwhelming majority of those drugs are entering through international ports of entry, smuggled in big rig trucks and small cars. You know, 90-something percent of these things don't get checked by border officials, right? They can't. The volume is too high. So one of the things that NAFTA essentially guaranteed was increasing the flow and the traffic and the volume of exchange across the borders in international ports of entry especially. So traffickers took advantage of that. They could say, okay, we're going to send 10 big rigs with drugs smuggled in them. We know we're going to lose maybe one or two, but the eight that get across, well, that more than enough makes up for our initial investment that resulted in the loss of those two trucks. Also with the free flow of capital. Now that you have the free flow of capital across the border, it's become much easier for drug traffickers to actually invest or to put their gains, their profit, into the legitimate international financial network, and it disappears, right? It just moves. And it gets accumulated. When we had the recession in 2008, there were reports that said, you know, the only liquidity in the market was as a consequence of Mexican drug money, right, that were in American banks. So if you follow the money in this, it takes you far away from the mountains of Sinaloa and Guerrero and from these stereotypical portrayals of drug traffickers and their hitmen. And it takes you to corporate boardrooms. It takes you to Wall Street. It takes you to London. It takes you to Switzerland. I mean, if we really want to do something about drugs and the war on drugs, we would follow the money. The problem is that if you do that, it leads you to really powerful figures and things get pretty sticky.
And it's interesting to see, if you look at the government of Mexico and even just looking big picture at the government of Mexico, it's always pretty much been unstable since its early days. And a president comes in saying he's going to reform things. He's elected into office and things don't work out. The next person comes in. Same story. And with this current president, López Obrador, he talked a pretty big game. He was a populist president. He was elected into office, and it doesn't seem like a whole lot is going on.
López Obrador, when he was on the campaign trail, and I've had this conversation multiple times with other journalists and colleagues, the way that he was presented, especially in the U.S. language media, was not wholly accurate. The idea that he was this fiery leftist populist, and I still see this description applied to him in some American and English newspapers. It's laughable to me, right? Because if you follow this man's career, he has said, I am a liberal in the 19th century Benito Juarez style mold.
Which means?
He's a nationalist. He believes in a political system that, if used properly, if you can weed out corruption, can guarantee a modicum of equality and social justice for all Mexican citizens. Without getting into questions of more leftist politics that we've seen in other parts of Latin America in the last two decades. And also, if you've listened to him speak, there's nothing fiery about the way his persona, his voice. But what he has had since 2006, the first time he ran for president, massive popular support. He's the one political leader in Mexico in the last two decades that has had a consistent, growing, loyal base of popular support. So yeah, he did talk a big game, right? And I think some of us who were hopeful that because he had all this popular support, because he was advocating new ideas, because he was essentially saying, we're going to end the war on drugs in Mexico, and we're going to look at underlying social and economic reasons that generate this type of violence, you know, we had a lot of hope that things would change. Two areas where I've been disappointed based on my reading of the war on drugs is his formation of a National Guard will create a federal police force of some form of variety as a way to mitigate corruption in local municipal police forces, and that's somehow going to tamp down on the drug trade. And then related to the second thing that I've been disappointed with is using a National Guard to batter Central American migrants, right? Popular opinion is on his side, and I think that's why he's cracked down so hard on Central American migrants. But for me, as the son of formerly undocumented migrants, it's unforgivable from my perspective that a Mexican president with his political credentials, with his level of popular support, would be committing the type of anti-migratory, anti-human rights approach to Central American migration. The advantage that he has, again, is that he has a massive amount of popular support. The political opposition in Mexico has no clear political alternative that can attract broad support. So they're left with tragic clownish figures like ex-president Felipe Calderón or ex-president Vicente Fox to lead the charge, and people haven't forgotten their role in creating the type of violence that has convulsed and taken over the nation, right? Former President Enrique Peña Nieto can't even show his face in Mexico, right? That's why he's in New York wearing wigs, going, you know, undercover with his extremely young girlfriend. I mean, so he doesn't even like try to assume any sort of political position in Mexico because he's so universally hated. So for AMLO, that's a good thing, but it's also dangerous for the rest of the nation, right? Because he doesn't feel that pressure of having to actually implement some of the things that he promised on the campaign trail. But we're on track to have the highest number of homicides in Mexico ever, right? Well above 35,000, which is incredible, tragic. His response is always, I didn't create this. It is my responsibility now. And our policies are going to take a long time to work, to play out. For a country that has suffered over 300,000 homicides and over 60,000 disappearances, that's not good enough.
Do you think that a lot of people, especially maybe here in the States, where we look at those numbers and it's just a number, it's not our problem, until some American Mormons are killed in northern Mexico by cartels, and then we want to send machine guns blazing down there to help Mexico with its cartel violence?
When that killing of the LeBaron family happened, all of a sudden I got requests to do interviews, right? A week after they died, a family of 10 were brutally killed in Guerrero and no one said anything, right? No, I think from an American perspective, Mexican brown lives are worth much less than American lives, white American lives. But yes, there is this dissonance between the value of white American lives versus brown Mexican lives when it comes to reporting on the war on drugs. when I was asked to do some interviews because of the LeBaron killings, my thinking was, well, do I participate in this constant performance? But I also have a chance to like get in a couple of things really quickly, right? One of those things to get in really quickly is the idea that a lot of this violence that's happening in Mexico is generated by American drug consumption. Ultimately, that's what's driving the violence. And since 1994, the availability of cheap, potent, semi-automatic or fully automatic American weapons that go down to Mexico and find their way into the hands of some of these gunslingers who work for drug cartels. There's a direct responsibility, American responsibility, for the violence that's occurring in Mexico. It's U.S. drug demand that's driving that. So we should really think, well, why are Americans using so many drugs? Why are Americans turning to illicit drugs that are deemed illicit instead of looking to Mexico and always imagining that place is always corrupt, always violent, playing on tropes that have been around since the late 19th century, early 20th century. They get magnified through different cultural productions. When someone asks me about the war on drugs, I always, my simple argument or thesis is to remember that it's a war against poor people. If we can accept that as a beginning premise, that leads us to all sorts of interesting questions and suggestions and propositions that can hopefully lead us to a more just future for the people who are involved in this.
Alex Avina is an associate professor of history at Arizona State University. He's the author of Specters of Revolution, Peasant Guerrillas in the Cold War Mexican Countryside. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our digital content producer is Bree Kirkham. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.